Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello, I'm Jess Phillips, and welcome back to Yours Sincerely. Now, most of you might know I'm an MP in Birmingham, but what you might not know is that I've always been a prolific letter writer and know the power of putting words to paper. So in this podcast, I give my guests a chance to celebrate three people that mean the world to them. Someone they love, someone who's no longer around, and someone who doesn't realise how significant a role they've played in their lives. And when we've heard more about each person, they'll reveal how they would sign off each letter. Cariad Lloyd is a comedian, writer, actor and improviser. She created and hosts the multi-award-winning podcast Griefcast, a podcast that examines the human experience of grief and death, but with comedians, so it's cheerier than it sounds. Cariad lost her dad to pancreatic cancer in 1998 when she was just 15 years old. Her new book, You Are Not Alone, shares everything she's learnt about grief and the psychology behind it. Today, I'm excited to talk to her about the letters she would send to three people who mean the world to her. Hello, Cariad.
Hello.
How are you?
I'm good, thank you.
Let's talk like we haven't just been talking before this recording started. How are you? How are things?
Cold. I'm cold. That's all I can think about. I'm cold and it's cold and I am cold. But apart from that, I'm fine.
apart from the cold.
Yeah, it bothers me. I'm a cold person, so it bothers like.
My husband's got Reniers. Reynards.
And he won't put the heating on with
and
that.
And he won't put the heating on, my husband. Yeah, and so he has one glove.
Oh, my goodness.
Like wherever he sits, he has one glove because he's he says it doesn't
hurt. How do you keep the romance alive in your marriage?
Well, I only let him touch me with that one glove now.
The warm gloved hand.
But it looks so disgusting when his hand goes blue. His fingers go literally white.
I've got two friends with it, who it's shocking when you see it, isn't it? Because you're like, what's wrong with your hand?
It is like
it's Reynard,
he's in like Lazarus or something. It's horrible. But he just pops that one glove.
He's fine.
If anyone listening has, you know, one glove that is spare, because we often end up with just one glove. Feel free to donate them to the Tom Phillips One Glove Fund. So this podcast is all about, you do one all about grief, don't you?
I do,
That's nice.
Thank you, Griefcast. Yeah, where I talk to comedians and various people about their experiences of grief and death, and it is cheerier than it sounds.
I actually think it's really cheerful to talk about death.
Yeah, it's not a bad thing. It can be.
My cat died yesterday, though.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Oh, I mean,
how old are
you? I've not felt much grief.
You're not right. Some people don't with a pet. Some people feel more than they do with people.
Oh, yeah, I know.
But I always say grief is grief. However you feel is fine. If you don't feel it, great. If you do, that's okay.
I mean, I just haven't been home yet to where that cat lived.
Yeah. Have you got another cat?
Yes.
You've got a backup cat.
I've got a backup cat, which is definitely not how I'd feel about my children.
No, it's okay. Some people don't feel like that about cats, but it's also okay to feel like that about cats.
But I feel like I am going to feel much sadder about it when I get home.
You will. It'll hit you when you see the little spot when they're not there, I'm sure.
The cat hated me. I just want to make that clear.
That might explain your grief, lack of grief.
I suspect that the cat, who I really liked, was a misogynist because he only liked the boys in my house. My husband says it's because you get out what you put in and I put in nothing.
The patriarchy strikes everywhere.
Everywhere.
You know, cats can be affected.
He used to pick on the girl cat as well.
Oh, well, no.
I mean,
Hashtag cats too.
Indeed.
It's not okay.
But I am expecting to feel grief. It's sort of like on pause.
Yeah, yeah.
The grief that I'm going to feel about my cat.
It's very common. It's called delayed grief. It's a technical
term. Oh, is that a real thing?
Yeah. It happens. It can happen with people, obviously, more...
More likely.
Yeah. But it's if you have to deal with something first. So if you don't go back home, or if you have another parent to deal with who perhaps has, you know, a health problem you've got to deal with, or you have kids that you've got to deal with, your grief can kind of just go to the side and just get kind of parked. And people feel really guilty about it. It's like, oh, I haven't done it. And it's like, no, it's just grief is actually very patient. And grief will be like, don't worry, it's not the time. I'll just wait here for you.
That's good of grief, isn't it?
Yeah, but I think...
It's a terrible name, grief.
I know. Actually, guys, it's very understanding. So yeah, grief... That's quite common. If you haven't been back there, you haven't seen all the places that are going to make you think about the cat. So when you go back, you probably will have a little moment. But also, if the cat didn't like you, it is easier to,
to process that. especially because my husband just rang me. I'd literally just got off the tube and he said, oh, by the way, the vet just called, the cat's dead.
Oh, no, I'm like,
at Westminster Tube Station, Kwasi Kwarteng walked past me and I'm hearing this devastating news. It was a bit like being hit by a bus. I was like, what?
Yeah, that's not how a good way to break happen? It. He didn't break that very well.
No, he did not break that
to
me.
He could have said, you know, sit down. Are you okay? It's Kwasi Kwarteng walking past. get him, tell him you need someone to get you a cup of tea.
Tell him that you'd like to also raise with him the massive inflation in the price of your mortgage. And then we'll get on to the cat. So this podcast is all about writing letters.
Yes.
Are you much of a letter writer, or were you?
I was, yes, because I am of the generation that, you know, did used to use letters. So I've got like a big tin somewhere of like letters I sent to friends when I was at school, and also like uni friends as well. When we first left uni, we were still writing to each other. And I do occasionally still write a letter. I'm not someone who would like, oh, never. But I have the worst handwriting in the world.
Oh, really?
It's illegible to me.
I don't believe that it's worse than my husband's.
Honestly, it's so bad. And so I would love to write more letters. But do you have a friend who's got really... I've got a friend who's got really good handwriting.
Oh, my
beautiful.
God. Well, I am a person who receives letters from all over the country.
I have
some letters that are actual works of art.
Yes.
And the contents of them is absolutely crackers.
I would write you a nice letter, but you wouldn't be able to read it. And I get so sad that my writing is so terrible. So I'm someone who, if I had nice handwriting, I'd write more letters. But often if I go to write, I do think I've got to put in an email because they can't read it.
Yeah.
So if I've had to write formal letters, I'm someone who has to practice. I have to do like three goes of the formal letter, and I have to write at my computer first so I can like look at the, because my handwriting is just appalling. And I do blame Thatcher.
You blame Thatcher?
I swear to God, I was not taught handwriting. I was not taught times tables.
I think that's like, all I was taught under Thatcher. I blame her for...
Maybe my school was bad.
For the first time the other day, I was at the Old Bailey. I wasn't on trial. They only deal with murder and terrorism there. My crimes are far, far lesser. I was at the Old Bailey and somebody, I asked someone for a pen to make notes. And they handed me a fountain pen. I think it was the first time since 1988 that I've written with a fountain pen.
Lush, I did like writing it.
Amazingly, like my handwriting became beautiful again.
Oh, you need the right pen.
I need the right pen. That is a key.
I used to have a really good fountain pen for handwriting, and then it ran out of cartridges. And where'd you get cartridges from?
I mean, used to just buy them from W. H. Smith's in big packets, didn't you, with a little ball?
Yeah.
And then when they were empty, you'd try and get the little ball out at school.
Yeah, get the compass cut.
Oh,
open.
My kids are—they're not. They're not experiencing any of this. On the letter front, I actually received a letter from the King and Queen over Christmas.
Congratulations.
It's not the first time. It happens quite regularly. But they sent me a Christmas card, which I am here to tell you arrived on the 30th of November.
Wow.
The royals cannot rely on the Royal Mail.
I also like that there's someone in the office who was so worried about strikes. They're like, let's send early September. Yep, saying September. And other people in the office being like, is that weird? No, it's going to be a strike. You'll probably get there 12th of December. No, got there too early.
So it's interesting times. So you've got letters that you've kept.
Have you
got any like letters from anybody famous or like letters of note?
No, I don't have any famous, but I do have a letter. So the reason I do the podcast, Griefcast, is my dad died when I was 15.
Uh-huh.
And I have a letter from him.
And that's
something that is like the one letter I've sort of kept, which he wrote when I was actually 14, very weirdly wrote me a letter completely apropos of nothing, just saying like that it's almost like he if he knew he was dying, it's a letter he should have written, but he didn't. So it's that kind of letter.
Oh,
it's like,
gosh.
I just want to say I love you and I'm proud of you and whatever you do.
And he didn't know he was dying?
No, just wrote it. He was on a holiday, not a holiday, he was working in Paris. And he used to sometimes send us postcards or letters. Yeah. And that time in Paris, he sent each of us, me, my brother, my mum, a personalised letter saying, you know, like, I just want to let you know how important you are. And he had no idea at all because it was like the year before he was diagnosed.
I mean, I started doing this because I was frightened that I would die suddenly.
Yes. Yeah.
Like, I was frightened that I would die suddenly. And so I wrote those letters to But I mean, that was more the opposite. It was like I felt certain that I knew I was going to die. Like,
well,
when
maybe he had that thought in his head. I don't know. Because it reads like a letter from someone who knows, but he didn't know. And so that letter is very important to me, obviously, because it's still... Yeah. And because when he was dying, he was a bit crap. Like, he didn't... No offence. He had his reasons, but he didn't want to talk, and he didn't want to talk about his death, hence why I do a podcast about it. And so I am very attached to that letter, because it's like, oh, it actually is almost like we managed a conversation, even though we didn't at the time.
I have the exact opposite experience, in that my mum died when I was 29, and she wrote an entire blog charting experience of it was like to be dying.
Wow.
And I'm, you know, I'm eternally grateful for that I have like 3 years worth of
stuff amazing
that she wrote down about what it felt like to be dying. So, and we talked of precious little else, I seem to, although, I mean, I had a baby in that period. We did stop talking about her dying to briefly discuss the baby.
Yeah, well, he had pancreatic cancer, my dad.
Oh, that's just curtains really quickly,
isn't
it?
It is really shit. As I joke, and I always get told off for it, but like, it's the worst. It's the worst one.
It's the one if someone had told me that's what you've got, then. Yeah. A friend of mine's mum just recently died of pancreatic cancer, and she lived for like 3 years with it, and that's unbelievable.
Amazing.
Yeah. Like, every time I saw her, I kept being like, oh, God.
Here we go. If someone tells me, it's pancreatic, I'm like, ooh. Yeah, so he got diagnosed in the February of 1998 and was dead by the April. So there was no time, really. And I was 15 as well, so there was no time to kind of have that conversation or work it out or be like, oh, how do you feel about it? It was all so sudden. But yeah, it is a pretty shit one to get.
They're all shit
because I always get letters complaining. My cancer's bad. I'm not saying your cancer isn't bad, but pancreatic, because it is symptomless almost.
It is symptomless, and there's just like no bloody hope, is there? There's very little research. There's very little.
Well, there's amazing charity, PCUK, Pancreatic Cancer UK, who are doing lots of work into research and trying to develop a test and trying to educate GPs, because it does actually have these symptoms which are almost similar to bowel cancer, but like, lots of people don't then test for pancreatic cancer. So there's lots of hope for the future, and definitely compared to when my dad had it, when it was like no research, nothing going on.
My dad has leukemia, and I can tell you now, right, the pancreatic cancer is worse than what my dad has got. I tell you now, because my dad has had that since I was 11. And I remember, because I think her name was Beth. Yeah, Beth was dying of leukemia on Home and Away at the time.
Oh, yeah.
And I was... she went out with... What's his name? He was Karen's sister. Anyway, just fell down a Home and Away hole. And so I was convinced that my dad was going to slip. Blake, that was his name.
I
was convinced that my dad was going to slip away on the beach in Blake's arms immediately because she had leukaemia.
Yeah.
And that was now 31 years ago.
Wow, that's amazing.
Yeah, and he said to me at the time, by the time it gets bad for me, they'll have come up with something. And they did.
Wow.
They came up with something.
God, good foresight.
To all the blood cancer researchers in the world.
Yeah,
well done. So
yeah.
I understand that there are other people who have blood cancer who will suffer
terribly,
etc. However, your dad's cancer, if we were to have a war between my dad's cancer and your dad's cancer, you are going to win, and by default, I win. But it's pancreatic. It's a tough gig.
Yeah, so I've kept that letter, and it's quite nice because I found it much later. Like, I'd forgotten about it, and then I was sort of moving stuff. It must have been when I was moving stuff at my mum's house, and I was like, "Oh, what's this?" And then I was like, "Oh, wow, that's exactly the letter I would like to have that I don't have." Oh, thanks, Dad. Good work.
Well done, Dad.
That's the one I've definitely yeah, kept. But I don't, yeah, I don't have any famous people.
You don't have, I mean, no. Lorraine Kelly had one from Tony Blair talking about dog poo.
So I know. No. Well, I listened to Jess Fostergu, who had her D-Ream fan club.
Oh, yeah.
Which, having known Jess for a long time, I had no idea.
So I have asked you to think about three people you would want to write a letter to. And we start with the person who means the world to you, obviously with the caveat that it doesn't have to mean that you hate everybody else. Don't hate your children if you don't pick them.
No, yeah, I know, I felt bad because I know Jess picked a child and I was like, oh, I'm not doing that. But I have two, so then it's more awkward,
yeah,
isn't it?
I wouldn't pick either of mine.
I'm going to be cheeky, actually. I'm going to choose two friends.
Okay, you can
so
pick two friends.
A bit cheeky, isn't it? Because they're in the same, as in, like, we're in a gang. So then I thought, oh, I can't pick one. It's
like
awkward.
Like Sharks and Jets sort of gang?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. We go to the streets doing clicks and high kicks and people are afraid of us from the 50s. No, it's my two university friends called Sarah and Vanessa who have just, I still in my head think of them almost as my new friends because they're uni friends. You know, you're like, oh, you're my new friends. And then the other day we had
Isn't
to realise.
Isn't that funny? Like school years.
Yeah, yeah.
I've got a friend who's literally like 30 days older than me, but she's a year older.
She's
than
year
me.
Above.
Yeah.
She's year above.
Year above.
Yeah, me and Sarah always say this about people. If we're talking about someone and we're not keen on them, we'll go, I think they're year below. I think they're year below. That explains it. They just got a different vibe. They've got a different vibe. So, yeah, Sarah and Vanessa, who I met at Sussex University, who, yeah, have just been my very good friends for such a long time. And, you know, when you sort of, you're getting to the point where, like, we all turned 40 last year and you're starting to realise, oh, these people in my life, like, 20 years. Mm. Like, this isn't like, oh, my uni mates. Like, you've moved past this now and they're still here and they're still a part of my life. And they're two of the most unusual, bizarre, brilliant women I've ever met. And I feel so grateful that they're still in my life and that the randomness of meeting people at university.
Oh, it's totally random.
It's random.
Just like some, I don't know, pencil pusher puts you in a block with them.
Well, we met doing a play because we're all like drama fans. We wanted to be actors and we met doing a terrible play. No offence to everyone in the play, but it was very bad. We did a version of Our Country's Good, which we nicknamed Our Country's Bad because we were very funny. And it was really, really terrible. No offence to people listening who probably... Look, the directors, you were young and you did your best, but it wasn't a great production. And it's really weird because I ended up at Sussex completely randomly and so did Sarah and so did Vanessa. Like, you know, and it's like, I was supposed to stay in London. I wanted to stay at home because my dad had died and I didn't want to leave my mum. And I applied to KCL and I didn't get in. I didn't get the grades. And I remember lying to KCL on this phone call being like, oh, I've got them to try and get through to someone. Because if you didn't have the grades, they wouldn't even let you pass the phone on. So I eventually got through to the English department. They were like, you didn't get them. You can't come here. And I sort of sat there and I was like, oh, what am I going to do with my life? And about 2 days later, I was watching Neighbours at my mum's house.
Oh, it's often Australian.
Yeah, I was, yeah, yeah. I was more of a Neighbours girl than Homeway. And the phone rang and it was someone from Sussex Uni. And they said, are you coming? And I said, oh, I didn't get the grades. They went, no, but it's fine because she had an interview and we still want you. I said, well, I think I'll have a year off. And they went, all right, we'll call you in September. Have a nice time. And so it was completely like, and I put the phone down and said, oh, Mum, I'm going to Sussex, but next year. She was like, okay. So it's completely random. And Sarah and V had the similar, like, Sarah was work. I should caveat this. Sarah is Sarah Pascoe of stand-up fame. But I wanted to talk about her as my friend rather than like people be like, oh, the stand-up. But she was working in a hotel with like Robbie Williams' dad singing songs.
Oh god, I remember when Robbie Williams' dad was a thing.
Yeah,
I've forgotten about that.
Yeah.
That entirely.
So then she like applied for clearing and got it. So like just completely random that we all found each other. And we found in that friendship with very, very similar, mad, creative women. And it was like, you know, when you meet people who talk as much as you do, jump around as much as you do, love acting as, you know, comedy and all that stuff as much as you, and you can just relax. He's like, oh, I can actually be my true, authentic, annoying self and you're not going to hold it against me.
Yeah, you can only really be really annoying in front of your actual friends.
Yeah, your actual friends. And we've been through so much, the three of us, and to still be friends with these people and still have the ability to. So when you asked me about celebrating, I was like, you know, obviously there's other people I want to celebrate, but I was like, oh, I just want to celebrate that long-term friendship where you have really seen the worst of people. You've really, yeah. You've had the rows. You've like fallen out. You've said to them, I'm never going to speak to that person again. No, it's over. And then of course they text you and you're like, oh, you're all right. It's like joy of long friendship.
Yeah, I very rarely have like, it's gone on longer than just somebody texting and being like, oh, I'm sorry.
Yeah. Yeah, we sometimes have a few weeks of grumpiness.
Like I'm always the victim. Not at all. Sometimes definitely the perpetrator.
Yeah. So yeah, I wanted to celebrate like proper long-term female friendships where it's just like they have seen you at your absolute worst.
I think that one of the saddest things about, you know, the sort of the world of drama and, I don't know, telly and all that, is that I don't think that female friendships are written about very well.
Yeah, it's changing.
I think it does. It is getting better.
Yeah,
but it doesn't leap. Like, I don't know the sense of romantic love that you can get across on screen or on the page. I rarely see really brilliant portrayals that are realistic, like how people actually are.
Well,
a female friendship.
Yeah. I think it's changing, definitely. I think what we grew up with, that just didn't exist. I don't know if you've seen a show called, I can't say this word because of my terrible speech, Broad City. Broad City is a comedy show with these two comics, Alana Glazer and Abby Jacobson. And it's like, it was the first time I saw a comedy show about two women that reflected my experience of just like, they were complete idiots to each other, but also loved each other, but were also sometimes thoughtless. And it was written by them. And that's the thing is like, a lot of comedy wasn't written by women.
Yeah, I mean, that's true.
You know, and I think Dolly Alderton's show, Everything I Know About Love, and Lena Dunham.
Oh, yeah, I watched some of that.
Lena Dunham's Girls, obviously, very skewed point of view.
I had to watch all of that to write an article about it. I've never seen it. The person who asked me obviously assumed she's the kind of woman who's watched that. I've literally never even heard of it. But then I got completely hooked on it.
Yeah.
I fundamentally hated every single character. Yeah, it was the only trouble. But then I do hate most of my friends as well. They are fundamentally flawed characters.
Yeah. Yeah, that sisterly, over-emotional, over-connected, like, neediness, but also, like, fills you up with so much joy and support, and the people you just can turn to when you're like, oh, blah, 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 this happened, and they said this, and they just go, yeah. What did you do? You're like, well, I told everyone to fuck off, and I probably shouldn't have done that, and yeah, I know. Yeah, I think it is getting better. I think the generations below us will have much more examples of, like, joyful female friendship.
It's just, like, I mean, I really loved Sex and the City for that.
Oh, yes,
I was a kid, but when I rewatch it, the way that they converse with each other isn't necessarily how women actually converse with each other. I think there is the, like, it, you know, nobody waits for... I know it's hard when you're writing a script, but nobody waits for somebody else to speak amongst my friends.
They don't
slag each other off behind their backs enough.
Yeah, that's true.
Like me and my friends. Like, we love each other very dearly.
Yeah, yeah.
But as soon as one thing happens, like, and everyone will give their
opinion,
completely heartfelt and honest opinion to that person's face. But they'll give a completely different one behind their back, which is also honest and heartfelt.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But we slag it... I mean, anyone who says, I don't slag people behind their back is lying, of course you do.
I also think like me and Sarah always kind of justify it, like, that's how you work out your position in the world sometimes, is by criticizing other people and being like, well, I wouldn't do that, why wouldn't I do that? What we've done is elevate bitching.
Yeah.
We've elevated it, gossiping, to a higher form. But yeah, of course you do.
Me and my two friends have one WhatsApp group that is just entirely to be like eye roll emoji at like various different things that we see on people's Instagrams. That is a total joy. When you see something, you think, oh, God, I can't wait to share this.
I cannot wait. You will not believe what's been put out today, guys. I got to tell you. And to just have people who just get it, because it's like you've all watched the same show. That's all it is. It's the same as you have when you're like, oh, did you see that episode? Oh, my God. It's like, we've been watching this show since year 2000 together.
Yeah.
So you know what references I'm talking to, or like the time that this happened. So, yeah, the glory of a proper female friendship.
Yeah, where you can start in the middle of the conversation. You don't
Put
in the context is really, because it's so tiring.
Who's got the time? I know.
My husband was born like two streets away from me. We've known each other since we were 12. We're basically the same age. And so we don't really need to converse anymore. Do you know what I mean? Yeah. Like at the point where, and I think that we're like, when you play games where they put you on teams have to be, I just think that's totally deeply unfair for me and Tom to be on the same team as each other, because I can just literally be like, remember that time? And he'll go, and he'll say, bananas.
I love that.
We have exactly the same culture, which is, you know, quite dull for my children, I should imagine, because they've all got like, you know, they've all got friends who's like, you know, got Iranian fathers or people from the Ukraine and stuff, and it's just me and Tom.
Two streets of Birmingham.
And we still live there.
This is your who do you think you are? Yeah. It's four roads, basically.
It would literally go like as far as the Tilesley tip. We're quite boring, really.
Content.
That sort of shared culture is really important.
It's lovely.
I think.
It's very connecting. It makes you feel very grounded, especially when the world is terrifying and scary, and to have people go, oh, do you remember that terrible play we saw that we wanted to walk out of, but we were laughing so much? It's just like a joy just to be like, yes, I do. Do you remember when the man got naked for no reason in the play and so we laughed? Yes, and they told us off. Yes,
also, you just tell the same story over and over again. Just tell the same. I mean, me and my friends just literally tell the same story over and over again. Never gets old.
It's nice.
The best. So how would you sign off a letter to Sarah and Vanessa?
Sarah and V. I always don't know how to express what I feel for, you know what I mean? But it would probably be, thank you so much for every single fucking thing that you've given me, and every single joy and every single pain and anger and love, because it's the most real relationship that I've had.
It is the most real. No one will tell you to shut the fuck up like your mates.
Yeah.
My friends just stop me and they're like, this is very boring what you're saying. Stop now. And we're like, I'm like,
okay, sorry.
Yep. So the second letter I asked you to think about is for somebody who is no longer with us. So who would that person be?
Well, yeah, I mean, I almost didn't want to choose him because I've just written a book about him. So I'm like, God, he's getting so much attention. But it probably should be my dad.
What was your dad's name?
Peter. So, yeah, he died, 20 plus years ago. So I stopped counting over 20 because I couldn't be asked to keep counting it. And I was 15 and it was very quick and very sudden, as we've discussed. And then in 2016, I started the Griefcast podcast. And at the same time, I became pregnant with my first child and I started therapy. So it was a big year for me, mental health wise. And it made me realise I hadn't really dealt with a lot of everything that happened to me, which is very common for what I call the TGC, Teenage Grief Club. So if you lose a parent at a young age, you tend to spend your teenage years having no idea what just happened to you. Your 20s making lots of mistakes. And nothing to do with that, actually. It's not even a big deal. It's just a thing that happened. I don't want to talk about it. And then you get to 30 and you're like, oh, I think that's quite important. I think I might need to deal with it. So when I started the Griefcast, I started talking about him publicly. Before that, I was a comedian. I never, didn't talk about it at all. I was a character comedian. So it was like not, Carrie, I did not appear at all in my live stuff. And so I would probably write a letter to him. Although I guess the book I've just written kind of is
a whole letter to him.
Yeah, I didn't just write a letter, Jess. I wrote a whole book.
Oh,
so
I mean, 70,000 words.
I win on prizes for best child, probably.
Yeah, I haven't read anything to my mum. Oh, sorry, Mum.
That's okay. Yeah, you're right. She wrote you a blog. You'd had the conversation.
We chatted about it. I mean, feels like you've like sort of dedicated quite a lot of your adult life to the memory of your father. That makes it seem like you're a Highlander. Do you know what I mean? I was watching Conan
my name
the Barbarian.
Is Inigo Montoya. Yeah,
exactly. I was watching Conan the Barbarian the other day with my kid, and there's a moment where what's his name? Darth Vader. It's not Darth Vader.
No, it's not
in Conan the Barbarian, but you know what I mean. The man, James Earl Jones. Is that right? Yeah. He chops off the head of Conan's mother while he's a child, and my son just said to me, "I mean, why would you leave the kid behind? That kid's obviously going to go and avenge." like, you know.
Pancreatic cancer chopped the head off my father and left me. And so I just like, yeah, and I think what's interesting, and I guess what's worth talking about is we didn't have a good relationship.
Right.
So often when I do the podcast, people assume, oh, they got on quite well. It's like a daddy's girl thing and like she's never really recovered. And I think if that was the case, I wouldn't need to do a podcast and I wouldn't need to write a book because it'd be like, well, I know he loved me. I loved him. It's very simple.
Oh, I think that's much harder, isn't it? Like, that's maybe why I haven't, because I had a really good relationship with my mother.
And when I've talked to people, I've said Griefcast, we've nearly on 200 episodes. So the people who have good relationships, as in good communication, and they both know the relationship is very solid and very stable, they grieve. They obviously grieve.
Yeah.
But it's like there's all these layers of grief. And when you have a complicated relationship, you have to get through those first before you get to just grieving. So you have to sort out all the mess that was left behind. And then you get, oh, here's just, I'm sad that you're gone.
Also, I think that you practice grief with people that you love and have a good relationship
yeah,
with.
Yeah, that's true.
On a long car journey, I practice grieving my husband. Isn't that weird?
No, I mean, I do a show about grief, so it's not weird.
Is that
you're talking
weird?
To the right person.
I practice grieving for the people that I never, ever practice grieving for my children, funnily enough.
Yeah.
But I do practice it for, like, my friends and... like I sort of like go over the songs that I'd listen to. I listen to them in the car.
Oh, nice.
And I think
good.
About how sad I would feel and what I would say at their funeral and things like that.
I think that's pretty healthy, because what you're doing is acknowledging...
I have a lot of long, boring car journeys.
You've got a lot of boring car journeys. You can't always listen to a podcast. And you're acknowledging those feelings that you have for them, and you're allowing them to be present, and you're not... What a lot of people do is like, don't think about it. Don't think about death. Put it in the cupboard. It's never, ever going to happen. And then, of course, when it happens, it's so shocking. And I think for me, because that happened to me when I was so young...
You would never have had the time to practice.
You know, when you're a teenager, your parents are, I describe in the book, like they're like the old sofa. They're just there. There's no point commenting on it. You never say, I love this sofa. It's great. You're like, it's there. I sit on it. It's great. What more do you want? And then when like someone takes your sofa away, you're like, well, I did like that sofa. It's just quite... It was comfy. I felt at ease with it. So, yeah, we had a very complicated, difficult relationship. And because I was 15, we hadn't finished it. And I'm sure you can appreciate this with teenage children.
Yeah.
We were right in the middle of, like, the real peak of, like, not getting on.
I was going to say, classic 15.
Yeah,
I'm
classic
afraid.
15.
It's a terrible year.
My brother was 19, so they had just come through a much worse relationship, actually. They really, really fought. But they just got to the point where he was 19 and he'd left school and they'd getting a job, and it was like, okay, we can meet each other as adults. Whereas I was like literally opening the door to like, right, here we go. Here's the shit relationship. I'm ready to fight you on everything. And when someone dies at that point, as I say in the book, it's like it's mid-conversation. So you're left with this, like, all this, like, oh, but I didn't, what do I do with all this emotion that I was ready to, like, chuck in your face?
Yeah.
Like, I was, like, ready to throw everything at you, and you're gone, so I've got no one to throw it at, and I've just got to carry it. And I was furious for years and years and years, absolutely furious. And then when the show came about, it really was... a need to process, a need to kind of talk about him in a way with other people who equally had complicated relationships or wanted to talk about the reality of grief, didn't want to say, oh yes, it's very sad and we've moved on. We're like, no, it's shit and it's awful. Yeah. And I still pissed off about this. And I'm so angry they died and the mess of it. And that's what I tried to put in the book as well, of just like the mess, the actual chaos and mess that grief actually is.
I felt just really jealous of people.
Oh,
Terrible. My brother, he's 10 years older than me, and I just thought...
got 10 more years. Yeah.
You got 10 more years, you bastard.
Yeah.
Like, it's fine for your mum to die at 40. Do you know what I mean? Like,
it's
normal. When I was a kid, people didn't keep their parents past 40. Nowadays, you know, with the old aging population and everyone having their children when they're in their 50s, that happens much more regularly.
Yeah.
But then, like, you know, my parents both lost their parents, you know, around, the, you know, in their 40s, maybe early 50s at a push. And so I just felt like, well, that's just...
unfair.
That's totally irrational. I had two kids when my mum died, and she knew my kids, whereas he didn't have any. And like,
but that's the thing. There's always something. There's always something. Like what we say on the Griefcast, like, it's okay to feel angry about it. And you know, I did a Q&A the other day, and someone was like, oh, my mum, her mum had just passed away, and she was like 50 something, and she was like, when I see anyone complaining about mums who died plus, you know, they're like 60, she's like, I want to smack them around the head.
I'm totally
and
like
I
that.
I said to her, like, but you're not alone. Like, that's what we all do. My dad was 44. Yeah. So if somebody says to me, oh, my dad died and he was 90, my immediate thought is, oh, was he 90?
Look at you.
Oh, dear. Yeah. That's sad. And then I've learned to go, well, grief is grief. And of course, if you're sad, that's absolutely fine. Like, but that took me doing the show and interviewing that many people and seeing their pain and being like, oh, I see. No one wins. Like, even if you get them for longer, you get them for longer, but then you have to see them deteriorate, or you have to look after them.
The frisson between the sudden or the long.
Yeah. And I have interviewed people who've literally gone, oh, I wish they'd had a terminal illness. I got a call in the night. And as someone who's the terminal illness club, I'm like, it's not great. There's call in the night versus watching someone really, really suffer. And nobody's winning. Nobody's winning.
It feels like the outcome is exactly the same. My husband's mother died last March, just suddenly had a heart attack. We saw her in the morning. She was absolutely fine. Oh. She was dead by the end of the day. My mum took 3.5 years of slow deterioration. It's shit all round.
And that's the thing, is I think once we can admit, oh, I've got the feelings of jealousy, and then you can see them for their, like, the illogical nature of them, and you can go, oh, okay, well, actually, nobody's winning. So now I can just get on with the grief rather than feeling guilty about the, oh, I feel, you know, I'm jealous, so that's guilty, so I'm not going to feel it, so I'm going to put it away. And then you don't get to your grief, rather than just like being like, here's the mess, that's how you feel, be honest about it. And then when you're honest about it and you see everyone, you can go, oh, we all feel like that, right, great, that's done, now I can look at, I miss them and I'm just really sad. You can just get to that bit.
I definitely got my bitterness about it from my mum, who was not a particularly bitter person, but I remember while she was dying, we were in a lift in Selfridges in Birmingham, and two women about my mum's age and with her daughter, who was a woman about my age, got in, and they were very, like, you know, well turned out, which already would have been grist to my mother's mill, but we were like, and we got in the lift and we're like, oh, hello, like, sort of just like being friendly and smiling, and they literally were both stony faced and didn't even talk to each other. And as they walked out of the lift on a different floor, my mum very audibly said, it's just not fair that I'm gonna die and she's not.
Good for her.
Yeah,
that's hilarious.
It's just like that. Everybody, you just feel like, oh, I'm going to be missing from the world more than this woman.
So many guests have said that, like, you know, when you see, I've interviewed people who are famous, like, actors, parents, and they'll be like, you know, example of Rosa Hoskins, Bob Hoskins' daughter, and she was like, you see the people they worked with on the front cover of a magazine being like, oh, 70 and still hit and all this, and you start thinking, well, how comes they didn't get to continue their work and their art? Like, so these are such normal feelings to have, and you're right, your mum's right, it's shit, shit that good people die, and sometimes arseholes live on, like, it's unbelievable. But that,
how
again,
is Andrew Tate still here and my mum isn't?
Exactly. But that's what comes down to, death is something that happens to us and we have no control over it, and that's actually what most of grief is about, is like, oh, I'm a vulnerable human, we're all humans, we all have no say when this thing will happen to us, but it will happen to all of us, it's absolutely guaranteed. You know, not everyone goes to university, not everyone gets a mortgage, not everyone has social media, but everybody is going to die at some point. No one's going to, like, buy their way out of it, even though they think they might
be able to. Some people think they might, don't they?
They think they might. But
who would want to?
I know, exactly.
What a horrible idea. That's worse for me than death.
Your dead frozen head joining in at shit Christmas dinners. Oh, great. You can't eat anything because I haven't worked out how to keep your stomach alive. But you're here. You're here to complain. I'm a bit cold, actually. Can we not get out, great-grandma, please? Yeah. I mean, leave her in the fridge. She's so annoying.
Your dad, I suppose, is giving a gift to, you know, the world in talking about grief.
Yeah, I don't think he ever would have expected it, especially it's the irony being he absolutely didn't talk about his death, didn't want to, was absolutely in denial, was like, no, I'm not dying, it's not happening, even as he was in the cancer ward. So I think he'd be very surprised that legacy had happened, but also very pleased that we were all talking about him.
Yeah, he'd like that. What did he do for a living?
Oh, this is something businessy. When I got married, I had to say what his occupation was, which completely blew me away.
You know, we only just recently changed the law to say that women, that your mum would go on it as
because, well. Because I was in the registry office and I said to my brother, I was like, Tom, what did he do? And he went, oh, I don't know, Mum, what did he do? She went, put business. And I was like, but what? It's like marketing, PR, that sort of
He's
thing.
He's a businessman.
A businessman. But literally three of us couldn't tell you. And I thought, well, that's embarrassing, isn't it? That I thought my mum would have been able to back
really
it up.
I don't really know what my husband does. I assume he's a spy.
Yeah. He definitely wasn't a spy. He had a small office at home and business happened there. He had a fax machine.
Oh, that's absolutely the trappings of business.
Business. And he wore a suit and he was on the internet before most people. Business.
Business.
Yeah. Got a conference in Birmingham.
Yeah.
What's it for? I don't know. But he's got a business conference. Yeah.
It's business.
He had business cards. That's my other recollection. There were lots and lots of business cards around. And I had to answer the phone and say the name of the company. Hello, PLPR. When I was like 12 and I had to take messages and pretend to be his secretary. He trained me to say, don't say you're my daughter, just pretend you're the secretary. This is how you do it. Take the message. And I was like, okay, unpaid, completely unpaid labour.
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, that...
Smart, children, really.
My children don't know they're born. We used to do unpaid labour. My parents worked in the public sector and still somehow we managed to do unpaid labour in their offices.
Yeah.
I feel like there'd be regulations about that these days.
I think these days she wouldn't get away with it. Yeah.
My mum's person stationary. We loved it.
We loved it.
Who doesn't love stationery?
Yeah, yeah.
And Max Peck's chicken soup.
Oh, nice.
From the vending machine in the hospital. So how would you sign off a letter to your dad? You've written a whole book.
I've written a whole book, but yeah, I would probably say, thank you for embarrassing me, always answering my questions, explaining a lot of things, and generally being a bit of a mad person who was nice to have around most of the time.
It must be weird not to... I don't know, like you don't get to finish the relationship.
Yeah
that is shit. I was an adult with two children when my mum died.
That's the biggest thing with young grievers, is that you don't finish it. But you have to... The thing is, you have to do it yourself.
Yeah.
And that's what's hard, is you keep waiting for them to come back.
You might not finish if they stayed alive.
Exactly.
We'll be back for the final letter after a short break.
How would you like to look 5 years younger? In a clinical study, people that had volume added with Juvederm Voluma XC in the cheeks perceived themselves as looking 5 years younger at 6 months after treatment. Look younger, feel like you. Add volume for lift and contour in the cheeks with Juvederm Voluma XC. Reverse signs of aging by adding volume to smooth laugh lines with Juvederm Volure XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems. But getting therapy has its own problems too. Like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable, too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit BetterHelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
So the final letter we asked you to think about was to somebody who doesn't know what effect they've had on your life. So who would that be?
That would be... I feel embarrassed because it's a bit cringy, but that would be Mr. David Bowie.
Oh, David Bowie.
David Bowie.
Oh, gosh, the debate rages about David Bowie in my house.
Yes, oh, really?
Yeah.
What's the debate?
Well, my children love him. Love him. There's no debate.
There's no debate.
But because my children are of the generation that they are, they have to think, they have to be certain that almost everybody from the past is problematic.
He definitely is a bit problematic. Which is harder for the younger generation.
The debate really is, that we would just sometimes like to listen to David Bowie's music without that being mentioned. That's the raging debate.
You know, I love 60s and 70s music. Like, that's my dad was a DJ before he got into business.
Into business.
So, his business life. So we had a lot of vinyl. He was really into music. And I inherited David Bowie from him. Mm-hmm. David didn't know. And you literally can't listen. I mean, all you're left with if you take out Problematic is Joni Mitchell. And I love Joni. Love Joni, but there's times you need a break from Joni.
Yeah.
And so if you like any past music, and that's not to say that we can't talk about them or be critical of them in that way. I think it's really helpful. But yeah, David, if you're kicking David on that list, you're kicking Bob Dylan on that list. You're kicking the Stones.
Oh, I'm kicking Bob Dylan,
though. Oh, you're kicking him.
Yeah,
okay.
I'm kicking him. I'm fine with David.
You're fine with that, yeah.
I'm fine with David.
There's so many, Bob though, Dylan. Isn't there? There's so many. But
yeah.
It is tricky. And again, it's not to say it's not worth a conversation. And
yeah, no. But I would like to have a conversation with my children where they don't constantly point out like some obscure thing that they've read about them on the internet. But, you know.
This is it, though, isn't it? It's like there's very good memes on the internet, like Reductress, where it's like someone devastatingly tells you about something from an article they read on the internet, and you're like, what else have you done about this? What else have you found out? Well, I read one article and I read they did a thing, so I don't need any more information. I'm done.
Especially when I'm being lectured by middle-class boys about things to do with sexual violence, having dedicated my entire life to trying to improve it. I am a bit like, oh, really? Get yourself on that pedestal.
Yeah,
oh,
I feel like you...
You're right.
Yeah, you're allowed to... If you're like, I'm allowed to... I'm listening for the music. I'm not judging. I'm not thinking anything else. I'm just getting my music here because my job is very traumatic. Yeah. And so I need this music here. And yeah, he's problematic, but he's given me the music. So I'm just taking the music. Yeah, I feel... Oh, maybe I'll be cancelled for choosing David Bowie.
No, you won't. You definitely won't be cancelled for choosing David Bowie by anyone but my son, who actually loves David
Bowie.
Actually
loves him, I know.
He loves to mention... that is slightly
well, it was a shock. I had the same thing as a massive Bowie fan, had been for years. And then when everyone started like admitting the past and being like, oh yeah, it was awful. And then when I found out he was also in the gang, I was like, oh no. Oh, I just thought that he was sort of androgynous. And you're like, no, constant orgies at the house with tea. And you're like, oh, how many, is it, what are we talking here? Like, if it's one you like, isn't it? You start thinking, what were you saying? Like, what did they do? So yeah, he is problematic. But the reason that I love David Bowie quite so much is related to my dad. And there's a quite common thing that happens if you lose a parent young is you find a sort of replacement parent in the public eye.
Oh, really?
I've spoken to a lot of people about this. So a brilliant writer, Mark O'Sullivan, his dad was Irish. And so he, without knowing it, somehow replaced his dad with Terry Wogan.
Well, that's a great choice.
It's a good choice.
Yeah.
It's a good choice. And when I interviewed him for Griefcast, he was saying, like, it's very... What you do is you sort of, like, when you see them, they remind you of your dad and you start thinking, oh, yeah, like, that's what they would have looked like.
Judy
that's
Dench.
What they
would have done. Judy
Dench.
Like
yeah, see? It's quite common.
Yeah, whenever I see her, I think, oh, Mom.
Yeah, because it's like it's nice to have someone who you can kind of age with them.
Yeah, she's that same age.
Yeah, and you feel invested, like, I hope they're okay and I want them to be all right and you see them doing
I'm
well.
Pleased when she's like walking amongst the trees.
Yeah, you think, oh, that's good that she's doing well. And it's like someone to put that, like, I guess, that love and care in a person who's still alive. But Mark said, you know, that meant when Terry did pass away, he was in pieces. And all his friends are going, you're right, it's just Terry.
Just Terry.
And he was like, you know, hadn't explained, oh, well, I've done this weird thing in my head. And his dad had died when he was 15, I think. So he was like, you know, obviously a grown man by this point. And people were like, Mark's really cut up about Terry Wogan. And I met another girl the other day. She said, oh, I've done it with Daniel Craig. She was like, she's much younger than me.
Oh,
and she was
gosh.
Like, Daniel Craig. And I thought, well, that's a good and interesting choice. Like, hot Daniel Craig. But I did it with David Bowie. And so the day when he died, my husband, like, knew I'd done this. So when David died, he had to come in and break it very gently. He was like, I've got some very bad news. I just want you to know, like, okay, are you
did
ready?
Did you know that he was ill?
No, I mean, he'd done the song, hadn't he, the year before? The one that came out, oh, I can't remember, I'm so terrible with names. He'd done that, he'd released that album, which was amazing.
Yeah.
And so...
Black Star, was it?
Black Star was the death one. There was the one before that. Oh, I've literally forgotten.
Because
where are we now,
I think? I say that because when David Bowie died, I woke up in the morning and I saw on my phone that David Bowie had died. My son almost refused to go to school.
Yeah.
I turned to my husband in bed and I said, oh, my God, David Bowie's died. He had cancer. I didn't even know he was unwell. And my husband said to me, that's almost certainly because you don't know David Bowie and you're not one of his close friends or family.
But
for
knew
you...
Him. But I knew him. Yeah, no,
it will have been different. Yeah. And I was a bit like, all right.
Yeah.
I felt sad.
And he released Black Star, didn't he, just before he died? And we'd been listening to it. I remember doing my tax return and listening to it over and over again. And I remember saying to my husband, he really listens to lyrics and I don't. I listen to melody. And I said, what do you think this album's about? And he was like, it's about death. That's all he's talking about. And I was like, oh, I think. And then he died and he was like, I told you, the whole album was about death. So maybe that's also why I liked it. But yeah, I had no idea, like everybody else. But it's that thing of the fact that he released new music.
Yeah.
Like, because I like a lot of people who are dead, like all that music, they can't, you can't go and see them, they're gone.
And did so, you ever go and see him?
No,
I did. I was
my mum met him once.
Oh, really?
That was.
Maybe he is your dad.
Well, yeah. I do think he's an extraordinary, like his voice, and I don't think you get many people like this. Although Adele, I think, is like a good modern comparison where it sounds like they're talking to you. And that is like... That is like the level of how, you know, religions exist. Like, yeah, it's just like you hear him, you're like, he's speaking to, he's telling me about this. He's not telling anyone else about this. He's talking to me. And I think, losing my dad so young and then him being, again, same generation as my dad, into the same things as my dad. My dad was quite wild in his youth. And so then when he would sing, I'd be like, oh, it's like I've still got that presence there. And I have a huge poster of him up still from the V&A exhibition, which that for me, when I went to the V&A one, I couldn't leave. My mum kept coming back being like, we have to go. And I was like in the room with all the music videos being like, I can't leave him because then I'm leaving like my dad. I want to stay in here. She was like, this, you know, the security you're asking us to. And also I want to go to the shop. Come on, let's go to the shop.
I mean, that's the point of going
that's
to
the
museum.
Only point of going to the museum. So I've got a huge poster of him up still. And I still just feel like he was just, and also, you know, when he died, it was, as people have pointed out, it was just before everything went to shit.
It was.
2016, January the, what was it, 9th, the day after his birthday, the day before. And that moment, it's very hard not to go.
It did feel like everything was going to shit.
Well, that year, you know, that year was a real tough year. You know, you get Brexit and Trump and then everything that's happened since then.
When I was elected in 2015 and my husband was like, did you break something?
Yeah.
Did you go into a weird crypt and break some sort of talisman?
Yeah.
And I'm like, I like the way that this is my fault. This that is spewing out is all my fault.
Well, it can't help but feel like David was an alien angel and had enough, and then without his presence, we can't find each other. That's what I can't help but make that jump.
I bet you, if he were here, he'd just be like, I think you might be overthinking it.
No, he wouldn't. He'd be like, that's right.
That's right,
carry on. Yeah, child of mine, welcome. And then he'd sing me a song and I'd cry.
So how would you sign off the letter to David?
Oh, David, I would just say, David. Dear David, thank you so much. I love you. You're amazing. And wherever you've gone, I'll come and find you. I'll see you.
Yeah.
Well, I don't know what mad heaven you're in, but don't worry, I'm going to get there, definitely.
Do you believe in heaven?
No, but I do believe in a fun afterlife with David Bowie.
Yes,
why
agree.
Not? If you can make it up, I'm going
to
believe
I
that.
Agree. And there's no downside to believing in that. You know, where's the... Yeah. So, like his Father Christmas, he said to my kids, why take the risk, man?
Yeah, yeah.
It's all upside.
Exactly.
It's a zero-sum game.
Yeah.
The only one. If you believe in Father Christmas, you might get presents.
Yeah.
Like, whatever.
If I can believe there's a place where he's just playing a small, intimate concert in Paris... Then I get to go to it and have
my
mum
said,
seats.
I hope that there isn't a heaven. What if I don't know anybody there? I can't be bothered to make any new friends. I was pretty tired at the time.
That's a good thought.
Yeah, she was just like,
well,
oh,
if it's
God.
Just me and all those people you hate, oh, no.
Or also weird. Just like, cause there's going to be lots of people there, aren't there?
Yeah.
Like, you're going to have to establish new relationships.
Because,
like, in the world, like, she might not just be near my nan. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
You don't, unless in heaven is just exactly like Birmingham and my nan lives two streets away from where my mum lives in Birmingham, heaven.
There's a lot of people writing letters to the head of HR if heaven is just like Birmingham. They're
but
like,
then,
sorry,
like,
this is
like,
not why. I was very religious for a long time. I did not sign up for it to be just like Birmingham.
but thank you very much, Carriad. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for listening to this episode of Yours Sincerely with Jess Phillips. If you want to hear more conversations just like this, make sure you click the follow button now on the app where you listen to your podcasts. You can also follow us on social media.
We're at Jess Phillips Pod, and I'll be back next week with a brand new episode. This has been an Audio Always original.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hey, I'm Guy Raz, and on my show, Wisdom from the Top, I talk with CEOs and business leaders about the toughest challenges of their careers.
There's lots of ways to measure success.
Sometimes a company has to bet against itself.
We wanted to set ourselves apart by having a point of view.
Businesses really impact people's lives in pretty fundamental ways.
On Wisdom from the Top, some of the greatest business leaders of our time share their intimate stories of leadership, innovation, and transformation. Stories you won't hear anywhere else. Check out Wisdom from the Top only on Luminary. Now, back to your show.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.